This week on Your Western Context, Danielle Smith's UCP wins a majority government in Alberta. BC's healthcare crisis gets overdramatized, and Aaron O'Toole says CSIS warned him of China's interference. Also, a tweet from Pierre Poilievre highlights the homeless problem in Canada. This is Western Context, episode 322, recorded Saturday, June 3rd, 2023, A Miracle on the Prairies. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. This week, we see the culmination of another one of the stories that we've been following for what feels like forever now. But of course, we have a whole boatload of news to talk about, and we're going to talk about that as we have been doing since January of 2017.
Yes, certainly there is a very big news story that happened this past week that we would be remiss to not talk about, but certainly there's some other stories that cropped up in the news and even on social media as well, which gained some traction, which means we should always try and have a look at those stories as well to look and see what biases are on display by the media and what actually really matters to Canadians out there in the news this week.
That's right, and that's what Western Context is about. Our whole goal is to remove bias and sensationalism from the media by telling the other side of the story or just highlighting facts and figures that don't get highlighted in the media. And in removing that bias and sensationalism, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we invite you to follow along with our full show notes that you can find at westerncontext.ca. And with that, we're beginning with our Alberta story of the week, which is the culmination of the election that had a four-week official campaign period, but in reality has been going on since October last year when Danielle Smith became leader of the United Conservatives. And this week, the votes have been counted. And right now, the UCP will emerge with about 49 seats and a majority government. That seat count may fluctuate going forward as there's a couple of judicial recounts that are on the way, but we'll have to wait and see what happens from that. It's very seldom often that the impact of those recounts changes seat totals, but we'll just have to wait and see on that. Now, the UCP lost a number of cabinet ministers in this election out of Calgary, but in the end, the NDP could not break through in what was going to be a very tough electoral map for them. And we're talking about cases where recounts need to happen, where Justice Minister Tyler Chandro lost his seat by about 6 votes, and there was another seat that the UCP lost by about 30 votes that will also be going to a recount, and that could easily add them 2 more seats if the recount goes the other way. But we'll have to wait and see what happens on that. Now, the tough electoral map was always going to be on the table for the NDP because outside of Edmonton and Calgary, the UCP won 37 seats. This means that in order to get a majority government, they would have only had to get 7 seats in Calgary or Edmonton, which they did when you count up what happened in Calgary. Now, obviously, there's 87 seats in the legislature, so 44 is the majority, but 45 makes it more comfortable counting once a speaker is elected. And the interesting part about this math, when you look at it, the NDP and UCP pretty much split the seats in Calgary down the middle. Now, Danielle Smith opened her victory speech on Monday night, quoting former Premier Ralph Klein, saying, "Welcome to another miracle on the prairies." And that's our quote of the week this week, because if you look at the numbers, you'll see that this race could have gone either way, but more on that in a minute. In the speech, she also commended Rachel Notley's public service, saying that, "I believe Rachel Notley is a loyal Albertan who loves this province. She is deserving of respect and kindness and gratitude for the thousands of hours she has sacrificed to serve our democracy. I hope you'll join me in genuinely thanking her for her public service." And with that, the folks in the UCP Victory Party room gave a round of applause for the NDP leader. Now, we'll get to more on what happens next with this re-elected UCP government in a minute, but first we need to take a look at how the vote broke down. There was a lot of hype and anticipation leading up to the vote, with the idea that the NDP might be able to cannibalize some of the UCP's vote share in Calgary and come ahead. But if you look at what happened compared to 2019, you, for example, take the votes of the Greens, the Liberals, and the Alberta Party, you can see that what probably happened is that the NDP absorbed those left-leaning parties as all of these other parties failed to crack 1% popular vote province-wide. Now, this is, of course, an operating theory, since that would require exit polling to confirm, and exit polling is seldomly done in Canada. On the UCP side, they were down a couple points from 2019, garnering 52.59% of the popular vote, while the NDP captured 44% of the popular vote. What we do know with certainty now is how close this election was. And most of the conversation about how close it was has been talk about how close the NDP was to winning, in that they were about 2,600 votes short, based on unofficial tallies across six ridings, from outright winning the election. Now, of course, if you're going to do that for one side, you have to do it for the other side. If you look at that same similar 2,600 vote threshold or so in Calgary, and you apply the same and you ask, well, what would happen if the UCP won the closest ridings by about 2,600 votes? It would, in effect, give them an additional 7 or 8 seats, including Banff Kananaskis, which would increase their current seat total to 57. So yes, well, the media was right in pointing out that the NDP were about 2,600 votes away from winning a majority of seats. The UCP was also around 2,500 to 2,800 votes away from only being a few seats down from where they were in 2019, which puts an entirely different spin on the way this election panned out. Now, the prevailing narrative was that it was going to be close, and it was only after Monday that we see that, well, the media wanted to talk about how close the race was, but they were only talking about it, how close it was, in the favor of the NDP's direction. If they're going to do that, they have to go both ways. There's also been a discussion in some media outlets about whether or not 49 of 87 seats is a big enough majority. As in, questions are being asked, what if the rural MLAs get restless, or what if more moderate members of the UCP get upset, and so on? What if someone goes on permanent vacation, or has an accident and gets bonked on the head? And with that, there's always a question, as has been put up this week, well, is this going to be a stable majority government? So for comparison's sake, we have to look at some of the recent majorities that were won. In particular, Justin Trudeau's majority in 2015, where he won 184 of 338 seats, represented 54% of the seats in the House of Commons. Stephen Harper similarly won 54% of the seats in 2011 with 166 seats. And if you apply that same sort of metric to this Alberta election, Danielle Smith won 56% of the seats in the election we had this past Monday. So with that, it's a majority government, and it's proportionally bigger than both the Harper and Trudeau majorities, so the question of whether or not it's big enough is pretty much a moot point. Now, with this, of course, it also wields more power than John Horgan's strong, stable minority government, in which he recruited the Greens for support, which was taken as granted, as though that would be able to govern and govern for years. And with that, any majority government is going to be is going to be more powerful than something that is backed by a confidence and supply agreement. So there's a lot of these questions that were floating around this week, and these all point to a bigger issue of what happened in this race. And as I mentioned, we don't really do exit polling here, but these points of maybe eroding UCP support, a close election, and now ultimately how big the majority is, are the ones that the media was talking about throughout the entire race. But the flip side, now that we see the actual result of what happened, has seldomly been discussed this week. Now, the UCP also almost remained constant in its support from 2019. And with that, you can question that maybe a few moderate United Conservative voters stayed home in Calgary, maybe a few of the Red Tories from the Redford and Stelmach years didn't vote for them, maybe something like that happened in Calgary. We can also pretty much assume at this point that the NDP likely absorbed the Alberta Party Liberal and Green votes, and when you get to that, that's how we get to Monday's result, where the United Conservatives captured about 52% of the popular vote, and this percentage is consistent in the range that we've seen over the last number of years or so. Now, when it comes to what the Danielle Smith government will do, it's expected that we'll see a cabinet in the next couple of weeks and then the legislature resuming in September. And it's imperative to note that with a new government, it's often best that that governing party move with speed to implement their platform. And that's something that the UCP probably wants to do, given that it's expected that there might be some new pieces of legislation on the way from the federal government, and that was something that was mentioned in the victory speech. Now, the premier also said that her government will work with all Albertans, including those that didn't vote for them, which is, of course, important for the people of Edmonton, since Edmonton this time did not elect any UCP MLAs, so they will have to rely on the people from around Edmonton, like Leduc, Spruce Grove, Strathcona, Sherwood Park, Morinvale, St. Albert, and whatnot, north of the city, to bring that Edmonton view into the cabinet. Now, as to what happens with that and whether or not that's a problem, that's something that can be discussed going forward, and if something needs to change on that, whether it be on the basis of some form of electoral reform, or maybe unelected cabinet ministers, or maybe a higher reliance on city council. In any case, all of those different ideas are topics for another show that we'll look at should any of them make their way into the media cycle in the province here, or if they don't. Now, Smith also suggested that the new government will need to work with parents, educators, health professionals, and patients when it comes to tackling the issues of education and health. She said, "We need to study the best systems and practices around the world and improve on the strong foundations we have built here." Now, reading between the lines, what this hopefully means is that the UCP will continue to ensure that funding follows students and that parents have choice in what kind of school they send their kids to. And on the healthcare front, hopefully it means that any and all ideas to make our system work will be on the table as long as they comply with the Canada Health Act. And that latter point is one that we'll be watching very closely, since this is a bit of unfinished business for the UCP from the last session, and many Albertans, of course, also want to see big changes to the way healthcare works in our province. At the end of the day, Danielle Smith has shifted to a more moderate tone and won. The goal going forward needs to be to get a good ethical government in place focused on everyday Albertans, which is something that Ralph Klein, once again, always talked about. You're noticing some similarities in the way that Danielle Smith is carrying herself forward. It was Martha and Henry, as Ralph Klein called them, focusing on that moderate tone. And looking back at what happened here, this was probably the most winnable election for the NDP. And we have to ask why they didn't do that, whether that's because of their policy setting a bad tone for business owners, their candidates, some of which were anti-police or outright communists, the Premier's Rachel Notley's former record, or just the NDP's brand. But what happened there is, of course, a topic for another day, as we'll be watching to see if Rachel Notley steps down. So far, she hasn't indicated that she will. Now, as we close out our 2023 Alberta election coverage, we'll be keeping an eye on Notley and the NDP's future and any developments with the UCP as they continue to enact their policy agenda going forward.
This election was always going to be interesting to watch, and elections usually are quite fascinating to watch, especially looking at the commentary going back and forth throughout the election. Of course, looking at the polls beforehand and seeing just how right, or more accurately, how wrong they are. But I think the election result, especially the seat distribution, is right about where both of us had expected it was going to be, which is interesting when you consider it was about 2,500 to 3,000 votes going one way or the other, which you rightly pointed out was very much speculated upon in the media as being very close to being a NDP majority government. But of course, the opposite is that there would be a much, much stronger UCP majority if the 2,600 votes went the other way. So, you know, it's interesting how narratives will play out, especially in the media, when they don't talk about both sides of the stories and they just try and look at the story from one slant. Now, of course, what's going to happen in Alberta in the future will Have to see, of course, what Danielle Smith is going to focus on, but definitely with a reduced cabinet pool that she has to actually look at, especially when you consider that there were most of the UCP caucus is looking outside of Calgary and Edmonton. It's definitely going to be a very rural based cabinet. But of course, it's a provincial government, which means it has to govern for everybody in the province, which means that there's definitely going to be questions of representation going forward, especially for Edmonton and Calgary, which have the lion's share of the population. But we're going to see going forward how Daniel Smith is able to wrangle this new cabinet together and tackle the issues that all Albertans are facing, regardless of what color of the party that they voted for. We're going to see going forward just how these issues get tackled and what's going to happen as we move through the summer.
Yeah, and when it comes to polling results and the way the vote broke down, we're looking at something people always said, you know, this is the closest election that it's been in the form that it's one of the biggest oppositions. And, you know, we can of course frame that in another way, that if those three seats on the brink went the other way and brought the UCP to 52, they'd be right in range of what the NDP had in their 2015 to 2019 term. And with that, you combine the Wild Rose and PCs and a couple liberals at that time, you have an almost equally as big opposition. So it really comes down to media narrative and framing of the way this goes. And one of the things that everybody talked about was that this was going to be so much like the 93 election, in which there was question if the Progressive Conservatives would be taken down by the Liberals, led at the time by Lawrence DeCour, former mayor of Edmonton. That obviously didn't happen, but I think a greater parallel to this election is looking at 1971 when the Progressive Conservatives took power. And with that, you say, well, that happened then. What would have happened if the Social Credit would have been able to hang on? That's probably what this would have looked like. And that's the difference there. The NDP were not for, you know, framing themselves as the inheritor of the Waheed legacy and framing themselves as the inheritors of the Progressive Conservative mantle. They just weren't able to execute on that, whether that be from the baggage of being tied to the federal NDP, their past term, or something else. They just weren't able to get it done. And that's where we end that. And that's the big question for them going forward, is how do they move on that? Because from this, it's very clear that there's a huge section of the electorate that does fall into that center and center-left range that might not be comfortable with the UCP, but the NDP seems immune to this kind of discussion in the media, and that needs to happen sooner rather than later if they want to make a move for 2027. But of course, as we mentioned, that's a topic for another day. We're going to put this one on the back burner for now, and if you want to help us as we progress through the summer and we progress through the next election, whenever that arrives, you can support us monetarily on Patreon at patreon.com/westerncontext. We offer three tiers of support there, starting for as little as $2 a month. You can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. And with that, we move on to our BC story of the week, which has a bit of a scary headline.
Yes, certainly. An article from Gary Mason of the Globe and Mail has an inflammatory headline that warns people away from visiting BC. Now, this piece was titled "Fellow Canadians, Visit British Columbia at Your Own Risk," in such a way that it makes it sound like BC is one of the most dangerous places on earth that you could ever travel to or visit or even live in. Now, Mason opines that, quote, "If you want to see what a genuine healthcare crisis looks like, may I invite you to visit British Columbia?" Now, let's set aside the fact that the Globe and Mail, of course, is a Canadian newspaper, which means that people reading it are going to likely be Canadians. And then to note that the people experiencing healthcare crises are not just in BC, but are across the entire country. Now, it should be mentioned that doctors at Surrey Memorial Hospital, one of the busiest in the province, and of course, Surrey being one of the biggest municipalities in the country, let alone in BC, they issued a public letter this week warning of, quote, unsafe conditions and adverse outcomes in the facility's obstetrics and the gynecology departments. Now, doctors blame the conditions for one newborn death and countless other close calls. Now, that missive followed an earlier one written by the hospital's Medical Staff Association that accused Health Minister Adrian Dix and the local health authority of not acknowledging the full extent of the emergency that existed inside the building. They even threatened to begin diverting ambulances to other hospitals unless something was done soon. Now, BC doctors, of course, have been in the news quite a bit over the past year or so, and they're furious and concerned about the deplorable conditions in their hospitals and are now going public. One of the nurses unions actually did a protest march near the legislature just a few days ago. Now, the doctors are saying that some patients are waiting in their ERs for up to 72 hours for attention. Last summer, some emergency rooms in the interior of the province had to be closed on weekends because of staffing issues, and there could be more of those this summer. Now, not just in the interior, of course, there's many smaller towns across the province, even on Vancouver Island and even in the lower mainland where a lot of the population is. Even in the smaller suburbs, there's been medical hospitals that are having to close down because of staffing issues. Now, of course, recently, Adrian Dix announced that over the next 2 years at a minimum, as many as about 5,000 breast cancer and prostate cancer patients will be sent to private clinics in Washington state, just over the border, for radiation treatment. Now, this, of course, would be the same health minister who has spent his career railing against the evils of private clinics in Canada and was beyond joyful when his government won a landmark court case curtailing the activities of private health care in the province. Now, of course, BC is instead paying exorbitant sums to send patients to the U.S. with their evil private healthcare system to get treated, which is ironic for those that consider that Canada's healthcare system is far superior than the United States. Now, problems at the BC Cancer Agency have been well publicized. For years now, those who have headed the agency and the doctors working inside it have been warning of a coming catastrophe unless more people were hired to deal with the approaching deluge of new cases, thanks to the aging population. Now, consultants warned as far back as 2006 that the province had faced a serious shortfall in medical imaging technologists for diagnostic and surgical procedures. Again, that red flag was mostly disregarded. Certainly, all of the cries for action for healthcare have failed to be heeded by both the current NDP government that has been in power for about 6 years, as well as the BC Liberal government before it that was in power for 16 years. Now, today, BC is missing wait time benchmarks all over the place. And Gary Mason writes that this may be the last province in the country in which you want to get cancer, because after you've been diagnosed, you can often wait a very, very long time for the next steps, which, of course, are steps that can be crucial to mitigating the cancer or even eradicating it completely. Now, a BC Healthcare Commission report in 1991 found that too many doctors were contributing to rising healthcare costs, and the solution was to cut back on the supply of doctors, including the number of spaces at medical schools. Now, the consequences of that decision are still reverberating today. Now, when doctors complained for years about the outdated and unfair fee-for-service model, their complaints were dismissed. Now, eventually, family physicians started disappearing, which is something that's been happening pretty much all over the country, but definitely has been the worst in BC. Now, of course, more than a million British Columbians can't actually find a family doctor, and of course, that number is still continuing to rise. Now, last year, we detailed a story where the government has finally changed the way that doctors are paid, and this seems to have encouraged more of them to join the ranks of family physicians and has even attracted more of them from outside of the country. But here's the main problem with this story, and of course the headline that is warning of the risks of even entering one foot into the westernmost province of Canada. And that's healthcare is an issue all over the country, not just in BC. And it's a problem that many different governments of all levels have allowed to get worse through various policies. Now, the federal government, for instance, while not directly in charge of healthcare, is certainly in charge of an immigration system that has brought many more people into the country, heedless of the infrastructure problems that Canadians are already facing, healthcare notwithstanding. Now, the healthcare problem in BC can't be fixed overnight because it's a multi-decade problem in the making. What can be done is making sure that our governments are actually making the right steps so that these issues are mitigated now and hopefully fixed in the future. And certainly we've seen certain steps that the BC NDP have tried to make over the past year, but it's been very, very slow going, and it's certainly not fixed the problems or even mitigated them at the point right now. So what we're seeing here is a sensationalist article headline that really is detailing what's going on in BC, but it's not really telling the full picture of what's going on in healthcare in our entire country. And I think that's the reason why we wanted to do this story, because it's just a sensationalist headline that really is trivializing what's actually going on in the province. And that's not what we should be expecting from our journalists in Canada.
And whenever, of course, anybody tries to do anything on healthcare, it's branded as effectively trying to take the so-called free healthcare system that we have in this country away from people. Anytime any change is suggested that might talk about changing how care is delivered, it's automatically shot down because the people who are influencing the government, the healthcare unions and so on and so forth, the governments of various stripes, do not want to go down that path because it creates a voting block for them, a voting block of healthcare professionals, of union workers, of union representatives, and so on and so forth. And as such, there's just really no way to move on this issue when there's countless healthcare systems in Europe and elsewhere in the world that can be mimicked. Yet for some reason, the American healthcare system is the punching bag, which nobody is suggesting that's the way we need to go, but that's always the punching bag that's brought up whenever healthcare reforms are suggested. And to have anything meaningful done in this country on healthcare, there needs to be an ability of the media to talk about the stories with a focus on facts, with a focus on what is happening here, what is actually happening here, systems that are in place across the world, whether they be in Europe or even the US, those need to be reported on without stigma and without influence from the very powerful healthcare groups that we have in this country. And until that changes, we're not going to see any meaningful change. And this is a problem across all the provinces. We're seeing this in BC, but at the same time, if this was just a huge issue in the Alberta election campaign that the NDP painted as a problem of the UCP government, when in reality, just like BC, it goes back years and years, and nobody's going to move on that.
Exactly. And nobody's going to move on that until it's actually acknowledged that this is a problem that is happening at all levels of government all across Canada. And this isn't just a problem happening in BC. It's not just a problem happening with the BC provincial government. It's something that all levels of government and all provinces can actually get on board with. And the issue here is that there's major structural issues with the healthcare system that has, for one reason or another, discouraged people from actually becoming doctors, becoming nurses, becoming healthcare practitioners in our provinces. And that's something that really is something that needs to be looked at from the very beginning. People are almost discouraged from entering into medical school because of the high costs and because of the lack of benefits that are actually going for it. Because after all, why would you want to spend all that money, go to medical school, wait years to get a residency, and then have to go into a situation like one of these hospitals where you're going to be worked right off your feet and having to be put in stressful situations every hour of every day that you're there? And that's something that not many people are equipped to handle, and not many people at any other profession are going to want to deal with as well. So it takes a very special sort of person to be able to handle those stresses. And that means that there's a lot of disincentivizing people from actually entering the medical profession. So at the very start of it, there are some issues that need to be focused on right from the get-go to make it so that these hospitals are not only a good place to work, but also a good place for patients to actually visit in a timely manner to access the healthcare needs that they need to do. Because, of course, with healthcare, it's not just like going to a grocery store and picking up groceries or going to the mail, going to the post office to get your mail. It's something that needs situations to be resolved in a timely manner. You can't just say, oh, they're sold out of the product on the shelf, you know, we'll just come back and get it next time. When it's a cancer patient that's desperately needing to be looked at, it's something that needs to be happening right away. They can't just wait for another day. So this is something that these issues need to be solved right away. But the problem is that these issues have been multi-decades long in the province. These problems have been, going on for quite some time. And it's really been something that has been a very long time coming. And we're now seeing the effects of what the boomer generation aging is wreaking havoc on our system, plus all of the immigration targets that the federal government has set that have brought in far more people into the country than our infrastructure can actually handle. That doesn't just refer to healthcare, but also housing, education, and many of the social supports that go along with that. You know, these are all issues that really take a lot of time to fix, but we would just hope that the governments don't make the problem worse and that they are actually trying to make it better. So at the end of the day, something like this headline that says visit British Columbia at your own risk really isn't telling the true tale of what's going on in BC or even in Canada.
Yeah, and you know, people say that, well, you know, COVID broke this. No, COVID showed that this problem exists and opened the fracture wide open. It already existed beforehand, and it just opened it up, and it's going to be something that's going to be even harder to shut after that. And there needs to be meaningful change on that. There needs to be meaningful change on a lot of things, and one thing that we continue to keep talking about where change has not come yet is the interaction of China and the Chinese Communist Party in our elections. We learned more about that this week with former conservative leader Aaron O'Toole giving a speech in the House of Commons to detail what CSIS, or the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, revealed to him during a briefing, which was very astounding because you would think that somebody like the conservative leader gets briefed by CSIS, they would have to keep that quiet. No, he went one step further and rose on what's called the point of privilege, where members are generally free to speak at will in the House of Commons. Now, in this speech, it was groundbreaking in that we learned a lot of things that we had not heard of before. First, CSIS identified four categories of threats that were aimed at Aaron O'Toole while he was leading the Conservative Party. They range from Chinese funding of misinformation campaigns directed at him to an active campaign of voter suppression against himself and the Conservative Party. Now, the first involved using the United Front Work Department to create misinformation against the Conservative leader. The second was related to human resources, specifically the use of groups of people working for or aligned with the United Front in Canada. And it's important to note that there was no real examination of the United Front in Special Rapporteur David Johnston's report on this. And this is very peculiar since the United Front's influence in Canada has been going on for years. It's something that we talked about at the very beginning of Western Context, and we're just starting to see how serious their infractions have been. The third category was related to WeChat, which is a social network used primarily in the Chinese community. It was also used by the Chinese Communist Party and United Front Work Department to spread misinformation and undermine the conservatives. And the final category was voter suppression, specifically intelligence, which indicated that there was an active campaign of voter suppression against Aaron O'Toole. Now, looking at this, O'Toole said that at this point, Canadians cannot rely upon the government, the executive branch, to discharge its role as defender of the realm. The problem does not lie with our proud, hardworking intelligence agencies. It lies with willful blindness of senior figures in this government and the senior offices that advise it. He also said that CSIS has warned him that he is still a likely target of Chinese interference and will remain a target long after he retires from the House of Commons this summer. From O'Toole's speech, we learn a lot, specifically in relation to the payment of funds through the United Front, and multiple journalists on this matter have said that there was no discussion of the United Front in the Special Rapporteur's report. We also learned that despite the report by the Special Rapporteur, there are no conclusions in this report that shows just how serious this was in relation to the level of seriousness that Aaron O'Toole outlined. It's at this point that we outline that Aaron O'Toole took a huge risk by unveiling this, since the vast majority of what was told to him by CSIS was not intended to be spoke about publicly. There are other MPs and other institutions that have undoubtedly been compromised as well. The other MPs that we know about so far that have been targeted by China at home and abroad include Michael Chong, who we've talked about on a previous episode, and NDP MP Jenny Kwan. This, of course, has held ramifications for the NDP as well, since Kwan is one of the more senior members of the NDP. And with this, the NDP have even started questioning whether David Johnston should continue in his role as Special Rapporteur. The NDP raised a motion this week asking David Johnston to step aside. This passed with support from all opposition parties. Johnston subsequently issued a statement saying that his mandate comes from the government and not the House of Commons, and as such, he would not be stepping down. As of Friday, this is where it gets really interesting, David Johnston has hired crisis communications firm Navigator. And people might not be aware of this firm, but this is the same firm that Hockey Canada hired after their sexual abuse allegations, and it's also the same firm that former CBC host Gian Gomeshi used. Now, based on what the mandate the special rapporteur has received, it's likely that the taxpayers will be paying for these consultations, and that's something that's not cheap. Hockey Canada paid $1.6 million for their consultations with Navigator. In the media this week, and by extension, we see that David Johnston have lost the support of almost everybody, including editorial boards at the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star. The government has also lost the CBC At Issue panel featuring Andrew Coyne, Althea Raj, and Chantal Hebert. Now, with this, apparently there's still tools in the toolbox for Jagmeet Singh and the NDP to use. Singh says that he will not force an election until the integrity of the electoral system can be verified. And at this point, it becomes a question of what the NDP is hoping for by keeping this government in power. You can ask questions, do they keep to hope working on their list of priorities and that it will translate to some support? Do they see a world where Pierre Poilievre wins a huge majority and they want to try and protect that from happening? Or do they feel that they just have the moral high ground on this issue and can get the government to admit wrong and correct course? We don't know the answer to any of these questions, but what is becoming clear this week is that the issue of Chinese influence is far worse than what David Johnston has already detailed. And with that, we need to underscore that once again, we'll direct our listeners to our supplementals where you can read the media reporting of Aaron O'Toole's conversation. You can see a transcript of his speech in the House of Commons there. And as well, you can see the news reporting that talk about just how weird it is and to a different level absurd that David Johnston has hired a communications firm to help him out. And we underscore with this that this is a huge story where more and more keeps getting unearthed. And the simplest action to shut it down would be for the government to say, we're going to hold this public inquiry because that's what seems to be what everybody wants. We're just going to, you know, bring everything out into the open, no matter how damning it would be. So with that, the question is, what exactly is going on behind the scenes? And it would appear that this story is going to continue through the summer.
Yes, there's definitely more to this story that we still haven't heard about, despite us covering this story for what seems like years, given with the fact that everything has been going on with the Chinese government and influence into Canada. Of course, the Chinese government has always been trying to get footholds into the country and have been doing so for quite so many years. Going back to the very beginning of our podcast here at Western Context, we detailed them trying to get into ownership of seniors' homes in BC, natural resource mining companies up in the territories, and many other parts of Canadian life trying to get into it. We, of course, see this with TikTok, which has, of course, seen a lot of use over the past couple years, especially with the younger audiences that have grown quite attached to the platform. But it's definitely something that has received its own controversies over the past few years. And, you know, this is something that are happening with our culture. But with the government specifically, there is a very insidious threat that the Chinese government has been trying to influence how people act and how people vote in Canada. And that's something that should be protected as a fundamental right of being able to live in a Western democracy like Canada. And this is something that has been going on for years, and we're only just now finding out about most of what's been going on. And certainly there's a lot that we still don't know because the government is trying to cover up and stop what happened from getting out. And this is something that the hiring of David Johnson as the special rapporteur was intended to try and deflect away from what was going on. But it's clear from his report that he didn't even delve into a lot of what we already know. And that's something that raised, of course, a lot of eyebrows and lost him the support of a lot of the left-wing media in Canada. And there's a lot of people out there that are now starting to question why he was hired in the first place. So it seems like the hiring of David Johnson has actually backfired on the government and is trying to deflect the discussion away from it, is actually intensifying it on it more. And now that we're learning more about what's happening to Michael Chong and Aaron O'Toole and even Jenny Kwong, who of course is known to many British Columbians as a longtime MLA and of course a longtime MP of the NDP, certainly this is something that crosses party lines, and it's something that needs to be investigated. And we have to wonder, the longer this goes on, the longer that Trudeau tries to hide what has been happening, we have to wonder what exactly he knows and what is he actually trying to keep covered up.
Yeah, and you know, at this point, speculation will do more harm than good on that, because there's a whole range of things that immediately come to mind that it, in some cases in national media and whatnot, it would be dangerous to talk about those things right up the bat. And because of that, because that's where the mind goes on that, you really do have to ask, you know, why is this not being put out into the open? Why is this just not being ended by the government, which, you know, once again, we see across party lines in a minority government, the opposition should have the ability to push on this, but it's going to come down to whether or not the NDP want to exert the ultimate in terms of their power, which is, of course, a non-confidence vote, because that's as far as the NDP could go on this and saying that, well, it's apparent that the House of Commons has lost the confidence in David Johnston. Maybe the House of Commons has lost the confidence in the government, and maybe it's that time. But of course, once again, that's something at this point only the NDP could decide. And we're starting to see this merging where the NDP and Liberals are almost indistinguishable on that. And that's something that's not good for fans of the NDP. But with that, we're going to move on to our firing line right now and talk about another story that really didn't make cracks in the media this week.
Yes, a tweet from opposition leader Pierre Poilievre was making headlines and has got a lot of people talking about the homeless problem, something that is not just found in BC, but across Canada as well, which is similar, of course, to our other story that made the headlines in BC. Now in the tweet is a 57 second TikTok video that shows someone driving by the Okanagan Rail Trail in Kelowna's North End, featuring scores of homeless people living in tents. Now, of the video, Polyev said, quote, "These images are not from a faraway third world country. This is Kelowna after 8 years of Trudeau and the NDP." Now, as of recording, the tweet has almost 12,000 likes and 4,000 retweets, with about 2,500 comments varying from supportive of the message, shock about the problems that homelessness has caused, and invariably some condemning the conservative leader for his choice of words. And now Polyev responded to an interview request by Capital News regarding how he would better engage local leadership to combat the national housing crisis, given his recent tweet. He said if elected, he plans to incentivize city governments to speed up development permitting, free up land, and lower the cost to build homes. He said that Canada has the fewest homes per capita when compared to other G7 nations. A Scotiabank report from 2021 found that Canada has the lowest number of housing units per 1,000 people of all G7 nations. Now, Polyev says that this is because there's too much government red tape to get through to get plans built. Now, to encourage municipal governments to increase permits, Polyev plans to link federal infrastructure dollars to the number of homes that get built. Now, conversely, cities that increase home building will receive additional money from the federal government. Now, the video that Polyev tweeted has been criticized as exploiting vulnerable people for political gain. When asked why he shared the video, Polyev said that while Kelowna is a beautiful city, people are spilling out onto the streets and living in tents. Now, he also blames the government-funded safe supply of opioids for the surge in people experiencing unsheltered homelessness, substance use disorder, and the rise in deaths from accidental overdoses. Now, nearly 12,000 BC residents have died from toxic drug deaths since the federal government declared the overdose crisis a public health emergency in 2016. Now, the city of Kelowna called the social media post disappointing and unfair. Darren Call, who is the community safety director at the city of Kelowna, said, quote, "This is an issue that cities across Canada are experiencing, and it fails to show the incredible work that's being done behind the scenes." Call estimates that there are at least 200 people living outdoors throughout the city, a fourfold increase over the past 2 years. Now, many organizations across the city have increased their support for the homeless population. However, the number continues to rise. Kelowna's Gospel Mission says that at this time last year, it served 90 people. This year, it's jumped to over 200. Now, back in May of 2021, the city of Kelowna set up what it calls an outdoor sheltering site on the Okanagan Rail Trail, where people could sleep in tents between 6 p.m. and 9 a.m. every day. Now, the main purpose of the designated camping site was to discourage people from camping in city parks and other public spaces. Now, the city has since expanded the allowance and estimates that 100 people are camping there daily. Now, the CBC posts an article interviewing two homeless people living in the Kelowna encampment who lost their jobs during the pandemic, and also included quotes from Darren Call, who says that, quote, "As a public servant, he refrains from delving into politics," and yet his quotes are pasted all over the articles defending Kelowna. Now, the main issue that doesn't get addressed is that regardless of Polyev's methods, it's definitely attention-grabbing and has got people talking about the issue. Now, with the more focus on the issue of housing and homelessness, it's more likely for the governments in charge, in this case Trudeau's Liberals and David Eby's BCNDP, to put forward actual solutions. Now, despite Trudeau's many years in power, it's an issue that has continued to get worse, and what has been done has clearly not worked. Now, the pandemic was incredibly stressful on all of us, and yet the quality of life has just continued to deteriorate since then. Now, at the end of the day, Canadians deserve better. And what a one minute long TikTok and a very short tweet does not say is that there are a lot of people working on this situation, but there's a lot of people in government that are not wanting to make things better. And that's something that comes down to who's actually in charge, which is the Trudeau Liberals and David Eby's BCNDP.
And we look at this story, it wasn't necessarily apparent to us that this was going to be the firing line this week. But when you see in the way the media handled it and the way the media treated the comments from conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, you start to see that there's very clearly one media angle on this. And in the eyes of the media, the other side is wrong. But that completely precludes any notion that there's something structurally wrong in the way that the country is set up right now when it comes to the fact that, as we mentioned in our healthcare story, as we mentioned in our other stories, we have seen record numbers of immigration into this country, and we simply don't have the social services, we don't have the buildings, we just don't have the capacity to sustain that. That's one side of it, and everything has just become strained over the last 8 years or so, that it's really time to start questioning what needs to be done to fix this. Is it structural changes? Is it little things around the edge? And just like our other stories, if you're not willing to have that conversation, you're not going to make any meaningful change. And that's precisely why this has made it to the Western Context firing line of the week.
Yeah, exactly. Especially with all the pieces that have come out since the tweet that have either defended Kelowna or defended the homeless population or defended the idea of there even being a homeless population without actually talking about what has happened under the federal government. And, you know, it should be mentioned that in that 8 years, as you mentioned, things have gotten worse and rent and mortgage payments have doubled. Overdose deaths have tripled and 1 in 5 Canadians are skipping meals because food has become too expensive, and thousands upon thousands have been accessing the food banks all across the country. So while this isn't an issue, just like our story from earlier talking about healthcare, this isn't just an issue in BC or just in Kelowna. This is an issue that's happening all across the country, and it's something that deserves to be looked at by the federal government, but this is something that they're not looking at, and instead they're going after these other social issues that really are trying to divide Canadians rather than bring people together and look towards actual solutions. And that's something that's disappointing to see, and we really want to see more solutions from the government and less upon the actual divisive rhetoric that we're seeing out of the politicians in charge of our country. So that's something that was very interesting to see this week in a story that was coming out. And really, it deserved a lot of context and looking into what people were talking about it and to look into what the journalists were saying on the matter as well. So definitely, it was very interesting to see so many defense pieces coming out of the woodwork following this tweet, when really nobody was even talking about the homeless population before Pierre Poilievre even started doing his videos and talking about how things have gotten bad in a lot of cities around the country. So it's interesting how he brought up the topic of conversation, and definitely continues to be a lightning rod of conversation of the issues that are going on around the country. And we'll see how this moves going forward as we move into the summer, and see if there is perhaps an election on the horizon if the NDP decide to change their tune going forward.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It starts with one opposition party saying it, and we'll see if the others jump on board with that. I don't know that that will be the case, given how closely the NDP and the Liberals have been linked at this point, but it is an issue that needs and probably should be the central focus of the next campaign, combined with, of course, the China file, as we have been talking about. And with that, we can head on into our Word of the Week, which highlights a good encapsulation of everything we talked about on this episode.
Yes, our Word of the Week this week is risk, which is defined as a situation involving exposure to danger. Now, of course, risk came up in the Gary Mason piece that said that people should enter BC at your own risk. But definitely there's a lot of risks that were taken by many people over the past week. Definitely issues of healthcare, issues of homelessness, of course, have their own risks. But definitely the risks of Chinese interference into our political systems has carried another huge risk of what could happen in the future if this problem is allowed to get worse. And definitely, of course, elections always have consequences. So there's definitely a lot of risks here and there in which people of varying different political parties decided to throw their hats into the race and decided to throw their support behind one political party or another. And we'll see how this election turns out for Alberta going forward, and we'll see what Premier Danielle Smith is able to accomplish with her new mandate.
Yeah, and of course the risk behind it is that you don't necessarily know what the political parties are going to do in the election. And we always say it was unprecedented that in 2019, with Jason Kenney and his UCP win, they kept most of their promises. We'll be watching that. But of course, all the other issues of risk when it comes to where we stand today as a country. And it's an unfortunate thing that that's how we move into the summer. But this is the discussion that needs to be had across the country in the media. And that's why we're here. That's why we're doing this. That's why it made its way into the podcast this week. If you want to read more about any of these stories, any of them at all, westerncontext.ca. There you can find, of course, the full show notes, including all the supplementals that we talked about. And, you know, we do this show each and every week. It arrives on Sundays. You want to get it right away. The best way to do that is to subscribe. westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And with that, we're on all the good podcast listeners out there, Apple, Google, Pocket Cast, Spotify, and more. And of course, we're also on social media, on Twitter and Facebook, at Western Context. With that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media are talking about and a lot that they aren't talking about, in describing what the news is of the week in Canada and how these stories and news articles matter to Canadians. Now, we'll do this whether the stories are found in radio, TV, print, or even online, even in social media. Regardless of where they may be found, we will find them and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.